Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to another bonus episode of The New Abnormal. We thank you so much for being here. Today we have an extra special bonus episode with Garry Kasparov, who's of course a former chess grandmaster and world chess champion, who has then turned to be one of the leading voices against Vladimir Putin in Russia, and he's going to explain to us what he thinks is going on over there with the Ukraine and Russia situation.
Welcome to The New Abnormal, Garry Kasparov.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. I just want to know how you grew up in the former Soviet Union. When did you get radicalized?
I'm not sure I like the word radicalized, because it's probably more of getting normal. It's my my journey from abnormal to normal. Soviet Union was a communist dictatorship, and I grew up as a kid who was surrounded by this propaganda from very early days. Soviet Union, it's a peaceful country, great Lenin, communism, decadent West, you know, it's all sorts of stuff, you know, aggressive America, CIA, Mossad, MI5, whatever. So,
right.
And it took a bit of time for me to actually see it through, but naturally my home education helped. My father died when I was very, I would say young, I was seven. And my grandfather, my mother's father, he was diehard communist. And that definitely had also an impact on one side. But my father's younger brother belonged to these Jewish intellectual circles in Baku, in the city of Baku, where I was born and raised. It's a, I always say it's a deep south, right next to Georgia. So, which is because a republic of the region was next to Republic of Georgia in the deep south of the USSR. And I had access to books because I was very curious. I was a voracious reader. And also as a chess prodigy, I could travel at a very early age, first inside Soviet Union. And then at age 13, I represented Soviet Union at the first under-16 World Championship in France. And that trip was quite an eye-opener. Because I could see the difference. I came back and I, as someone with a critical mind, I couldn't help comparing things and reading books and listening to the propaganda and then just analyzing it. And it didn't take long for me to understand that the gap between reality and Soviet propaganda was too big to cover. At very early days, as a teenager, I already saw that the way that the Soviet Union was built and the country has been developed, it was a road to perdition. It was abnormal. So that you may call radicalization by the Soviet standards. Though, right. Until I became world champion in 1985, so I played by the rules, because all I wanted is to win the title, and naturally, being half Armenian, half Jewish boy from Baku was not sort of a great asset of playing the darling of Soviet system, a Russian champion, Anatoly Karpov. That's the first phase of what you call radicalization.
Yes.
And the second one began after I won my title in 1985, became the youngest world champion in history. And I knew already that I could afford more than ordinary Soviet citizens, because in the Soviet Union, chess was one of the most influential games. The Soviet propaganda always wanted to use chess as a demonstration of the communist superiority over decadent West, like intellectual superiority. And that's why the world champions, they carried very special prestige in the eyes of the Soviet citizens, almost like a sacred cows, or high priests of intellectual dominance of the Soviet Union. And I turned this status into my advantage, trying to push for opening up. Of course, I was lucky. It was Gorbachev who was in power. And the Soviet Union was gradually opening up, though I was not happy with the pace of the reforms, because I saw quite early that Gorbachev's plans were to modernize socialism, modernize communist state, make it more competitive, but not to turn it into democracy.
How long has it been since you've lived in the Soviet Union?
The Soviet Union collapsed in 1991.
Well, I know, but I mean Russia. And
how long? I spent first 28 years of my life. Yes, I was born in 1963. So, and I was very happy to see the end of this monstrous state in 1991, because I was already a very active part of anti-communist opposition. It's the nascent democratic movement in Russia. I was the first Soviet athlete who refused to play under Soviet flag all the way back in September 1990, when I played my fifth and the last World Championship match against Anatoly Karpov. And it started here in New York City. And I demanded to have a Russian flag. A Russian tricolor, not the red flag of the Communist Party, and it ended up with open conflict, and after Game Four, the International Chess Federation, under pressure of the Soviet delegation, Karpov delegation, removed both flags, which fine with me. So I was quite pleased that the no more Soviet flag was standing at the table, and in 1991. I thought, as many of us, that was the end of history. We all remember the great book of Francis Fukuyama back in 1992. So calling the end of this clash between liberal democracies and totalitarian ideology. And we all thought that the future would be bright. But unfortunately, we forgot that the evil doesn't die altogether. It could be buried for a while under the rubble of Berlin Wall. But the moment we lose our vigilance, the moment we turn complacent, it sprouts out. For me, another stage of my active engagement in this fight against totalitarianism and against KGB dictatorship began in year 2000, when, to my horror, I saw the KGB Lieutenant Colonel Vladimir Putin took over from Boris Yeltsin. And while the whole world was mesmerized by the young, strong, dynamic new Russian president who made many good statements, I heard something else. I heard Putin's own words. The collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. Or another quote from him, once KGB, always KGB. There were no former KGB officers. And for me, those were harbingers of perilous times ahead of us. And I was not surprised that one of the first actions of Putin as the president of Russia was to restore the Soviet anthem. Again, another clear demonstration of where his heart was and what he would do if he would be given this chance. And unfortunately, the free world turned a blind eye on Putin's actions and even on his own words, like his speech in Munich at Security Conference in Europe 15 years ago. 15 years ago, in February 2007, when he talked about return to the spheres of influence and Russia's right to have direct or indirect control of neighboring states.
When you watch now, what do you see happening?
I'm not surprised, because I've been saying all along about Putin's plans, and also he quite helped, just by confirming it, both by his words and his actions. After his speech in Munich, he attacked the Republic of Georgia. And in 2008, I wrote an article saying that since the free world showed no resistance to Putin's attempts to redesign the borders and exercise control of the former Soviet republics, we could expect him going further, and Ukraine will be next. People asked me, how did you know? I said, I just looked at the map. And I have no doubts that Putin would try to find good moment to seize part of Ukrainian territory, starting with Crimea, and also will do his best to demolish Ukrainian sovereignty, because democratic, prosperous Ukraine is the greatest threat to Putin's dictatorship in Russia. But I also said many times that while Vladimir Putin was our problem in Russia, and it also was a problem for neighboring states, many of them former Soviet republics, he would be eventually a threat to everybody. Because dictators, they never ask why. They always ask why not. And if Putin could go away with his aggression against the Republic of Georgia or other neighboring countries, or he could get away with his support to bloody dictators like Bashar al-Assad, his support of North Korean dictatorship or Venezuelan dictatorship, eventually he would see the West too weak to oppose his direct actions inside the free world. So for me, Putin's attack on American democracy starting in 2015, an open assault by propping up Donald Trump's candidacy, was a natural continuation of his policies of building troll factories and fake news industry back in Russia in 2004, 2005, and exercising these powers first in Russian-speaking universe, neighboring countries, and then moving to Europe. And now he feels that he could do whatever. Though the last few weeks, I think hopefully they brought him to reality, because first time, American administration, it's actually the first American administration, there were four of them already that had this chance, but the first one that demonstrated that there were limits for Putin's expansionism. And that's why I think Putin now is contemplating his next move, recognizing that those are not just words, not lip service, not empty warnings, but could be serious consequences if he would continue his aggressive expansionist policy.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Let's face it, after a night with drinks, I don't bounce back the next day like I used to. I have to make a choice. I can either have a great night or a great next day. That is until I found ZBiotics.
ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic.
It was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking.
Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut.
It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day.
ZBiotics produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. Just remember to make ZBiotics your first drink of the night, drink responsibly, and you'll feel your best tomorrow.
So, I first gave ZBiotics a try when I was having an existential crisis at a Dave & Buster's. I drank it before my first dangerous waters punch, and you wouldn't believe how on top of my game, no pun intended, I felt the very next morning.
Vacations, weddings, birthdays, and reunions. There's so much going on. Get the most out of your spring plans by stocking up on pre-alcohol now.
Go to zbiotics.com/abnormal to get 15% off your first order when you use abnormal at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with 100% money-back guarantee, so if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked.
Remember to head to zbiotics.com/abnormal and use the code abnormal at checkout for 15% off. Thank you, ZBiotics, for sponsoring this episode and our good times.
Putin is absolutely a dictator and he's power hungry and he wants to, I mean, everything we've seen shows that he wants to sort of reunite the Soviet Union, whatever that looks like. But my question to you is there also are, with Ukraine, there's an oil and gas component for him and Putin has been very interested in money. He has an opportunity here because of the way with the pipelines and the price of gas right now where, you know, he's turned off the spigot and he could turn it back on and make a lot of money and not go to war with Ukraine. Do you think there's a chance he does that, or do you think he just is so single-minded?
Oh, it's a great question because it reveals the true nature of Putin's regime. It's not the classical dictatorship of the 20th century. It's not just imperialism or ideology. It's more like a mafia state. You can say that every country has its own mafia, but in Russia, mafia has its own state. So Putin's power is based on money and control of money. And we have to recognize that he controls directly or indirectly more money than any other individual in human history. If you look at the Russian annual budget, if you look at all the funds allocated by Russian government, if you look at all the fortunes of oligarchs, most of them just directly connected to Putin, we may end up with an amount exceeding $1 trillion. And Putin proved that he was not shy of using this money to buy, call it favors, from Western politicians, from Western businesses. So when you look around, you'll find out that so many former politicians, hopefully only former, mostly Europeans, of course, are directly working for Putin, like former Chancellor of Germany, Schröder, former Prime Minister of France, Fillon, former Prime Minister of Finland, Lipponen. It's a long, long, long list. And Russian oligarchs have been most generous by donating money to the charities. And guess, you know, how many of these billions and billions of dollars spent on charities in England or in European Union found its way to the organizations that are related to policy makers. So Putin built the most sophisticated network ever built to lobby his interest, and he gets supported, as you pointed out correctly, from oil and gas. Russia has nothing else. It's all about natural resources of Russia that are being sold and profits being allocated in the hands of Putin's cronies. I said that it's the Putin found the magic formula of combining Karl Marx and Adam Smith. So it's he's nationalizing expenses and privatizing profits. And all the profits and end up in the pockets of those related to him. But this money is not kept in Russia, it's not kept in China, it's not kept in Iran or Venezuela. It's in the free world. It's all way, you know, just from Riga in Latvia to San Francisco, or from Copenhagen to Naples. Probably you can mention Australia as well. It's very important for Putin to make sure that this financial network is intact. But as everybody talked about sanctions, Putin laughed at them for a simple reason. He was not really affected by the sanctions, neither him nor his oligarchs. You can simply look at a number of Russian oligarchs in the Forbes list. This number grew after Putin's invasion of Ukraine and annexation of Crimea in 2014. No matter what Angela Merkel, the former Chancellor of Germany, said about Putin, what Putin looked at is an amount of German gas that had been sold. So, and his amount doubled since 2014. So it's the first time when Putin could be facing a threat of Europe cutting this gas supply, though it's painful for Europe. Everybody understands it. But Europe buys one-third of gas.
It's worse for Europe than it is for Putin.
This is about leverage. So Europe buys one-third of its gas supply from Putin. Putin sells 80% of its gas supply, of gas production to Europe. So who has the leverage? But the problem is that corrupt European politicians, they never wanted, you know, to take a strong stand against Putin. But now, thanks to the change of the position of this current administration, hopefully Europe and most of Europe, still, you know, Germany is lagging behind, France's position is questionable, but most of Europe now is lining up to take the final stand against Putin.
The Nord Stream undermines all of this, right?
Yes, Nord Stream, and that's why I was very critical of Biden administration decision not to sanction, I leave the sanctions against Nord Stream. But I also understand the rationale. They desperately tried to bring Germany aboard. But Nord Stream is still, you know, it's built, but it is still not open because it has to be sanctioned by European Union. And I think now that's what is part of this game. I think Putin understands that there is a real threat that if he attacks Ukraine, if his troops cross demarcation line again, and I said demarcation line because he already invaded Ukraine in 2014, then he would be running a real risk of Nord Stream 2 being shut down.
It's almost like when Germany decided to sort of turn its back on nuclear power, they set themselves up for this.
2011, yes. After the Fukushima disaster, they made this decision,
right,
which I think was stupid. Because as of now, this is the only alternative. If we want just to have the real, call it green policy, so there's no alternative to oil and gas but nuclear. But this decision made them dependent on Putin. That's what Putin loved.
Right. And that was when he really had the power.
Yes, but look, you may call it water under the bridge because Germany had years and years to build alternative supplies. Yes. Let's say this is that the nuclear was out of question. But there are many other opportunities to build alternative pipelines. So these big, you know, gas deposits in Mediterranean Sea. So that's next to Israel, between Israel and Cyprus. So, but you have to work with this. Then there are massive gas deposits and opportunity to build the gas pipelines from the south. It's Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan. All of these projects required, and I'm not even talking about American shale gas, but all these projects required policy. It's strategy. And what's happened in Europe, that's where Germany played dominating role under leadership of Angela Merkel. She was in power for 16 years. That they reneged on all these alternative pipelines, on all these opportunities to reduce the dependence of Europe on Russian gas. So that's why they put Putin in a very powerful position. But now, look, with America back in the game, America's leadership being partially restored, so Putin recognizes that even with all his lobbyists and agents in Europe, mostly in Germany, Austria, and France, he may not be able to prevent real sanctions to hurt him and NATO building strong defense lines against any possible aggression.
Knowing what you know about your experience of growing up there and Putin and all of this, if you were Ukraine, what would you do?
Well, look, I think Ukraine has been doing what it could. So it's preparing for war because the only way to stop Putin aggression is to be prepared for war. Putin will make a decision to cross or not to cross this demarcation line and to attack Ukraine further, to invade Ukraine further, based on his calculation of potential losses. What's the cost? And the cost could be prohibitive. As of now, I think that Ukraine enjoyed, first time in many years, massive support from the free world led by America. Of course, we still have exceptions. Shameful position of Germany that refused to send a lethal weapon. Surprising to me, a Canadian decision, considering the 1.5 or so million Ukrainians living there, decision of Canadian Prime Minister Trudeau not to sell a lethal weapon to Ukraine. But you have Great Britain. You have, of course, America. You have American allies like Poland and Baltic states. So Ukraine is being prepared. It tells me that the cost, if you combine the potential military cost with thousands of body bags sent back to Russia, because then the war will be bloody, and also potential economic cost, because America may force now a German hand and to stop Nord Stream 2. I think the war is less likely these days. And also, I'm listening to Russian propaganda. And the last 48 hours after they received the American response, which was fairly tough, they are changing gears. So it's still very belligerent rhetoric. It's not like we're going to war tomorrow. It's basically, our enemy's expecting us to fight, but maybe we should be smarter. So it tells me that there is the growing hesitations in Kremlin. And if I have to give you a forecast now, I think the war today is much less likely than 2 weeks ago, because first time Putin met with a strong response from the Western coalition led by the United States.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. This was great. I'm so glad we got you to talk about this.
Molly, always a pleasure. Thank you very much.
On that note, we'll wrap this episode of The New Abnormal from The Daily Beast. In future episodes, we'll be talking to smart folks from The Daily Beast and beyond, from media, culture, politics, and science, who will help us understand what's happening to our country and the world. We hope you'll subscribe to us on your favorite podcast app and share the show on social media. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you again on the next episode.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.